The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. This audiobook narration presents Need-Based Selling: Discovery Questions for Modern B2B and Consumer Sales. Topic Introduction. The room is quiet enough to hear the laptop fan. The seller is on the last slide, and the buyer has already stopped looking at it. A comparison sheet lies open beside a notebook full of internal questions. The conversation is courteous, even warm. That is the danger. The deal can still drift away without anyone saying no. That scene could unfold in New York, Singapore, or Sao Paulo.
It belongs to a world where buyers arrive informed. Comparison pages are already open, and feature lists are easy to obtain. In crowded categories, feature-first selling feels orderly, but it often misses the center of the decision. The old habit of leading with the category, the product, and the price can sound efficient while leaving the buyer's real problem untouched. Buyers are not shopping for abstractions. They are looking for relief from a problem, progress toward an outcome, and confidence that the choice will stand up later. The modern discipline of selling did not emerge from nowhere.
In the 1960s, Xerox helped turn sales into something that could be taught, observed, and repeated. In training rooms, managers could watch a rep's instinct become a repeatable sequence instead of a lucky performance. That mattered because it moved selling away from pure instinct and into the realm of craft. But the field still tended to treat the presentation as the main event. Later, Neil Rackham's 1988 book, Spin Selling, sharpened the question that many experienced sellers had been circling for years. His field research showed that better questions often change the shape of the deal more than a smoother monologue.
And behind that commercial lesson sat a quieter one associated with Carl Rogers. In Rogers' world, listening was not politeness. It was a method for finding what another person really meant. Later consultative models kept pressing in the same direction, away from recital and toward diagnosis. Understanding has to come before persuasion. Needs-based selling grows from that history, but it is not simply a friendlier style. It is a stricter one. It asks what the buyer is actually trying to change and why that change matters now rather than later. A latent need is a real problem that still feels hazy, normal, or easy to postpone.
An explicit need is the same problem once it has been named in terms of an outcome worth pursuing. Discovery is the structured diagnosis that moves a conversation from assumption to evidence. It is not small talk with better manners. It is the work of learning what is happening, what it costs, who feels it, and what would make change worth the effort. In business-to-business selling, that difference can be decisive. A plant manager considering industrial software is not buying dashboards for their own sake.
Operations may be buying fewer shutdowns. Finance may be buying a return that can be defended. And information technology may be buying a system that does not create fresh security risk. A seller who hears only the surface request will miss the real decision. A seller who hears the stakes can see why the same offer means different things to different people. One person cares about speed. Another cares about exposure. Another cares about adoption. All three can be right at once. The same logic appears in a household purchase, only in plainer language. A family choosing home internet is not buying speed in the abstract.
It is buying stable video calls, reliable schoolwork, predictable billing, and support that still responds after installation. The context is different, but the buying logic is familiar. What problem does this solve? What happens if it fails? Is the gain worth the money, the effort, and the risk of switching? Across markets, those questions are shaped by local priorities. Some buyers put return on investment first.
others care more about compliance, resilience, convenience, or trust. Decision criteria are the standards by which an option is judged, and they rarely live in only one dimension.
This audiobook follows that logic from the first useful question to the final ask. It stays close to the moment when a seller stops performing and starts diagnosing, because that is where a real sale begins to take shape. It asks for more exactness, not more theater. Along the way, it shows why some polished conversations leave no mark, while others seem to say less and understand more. The central tension is simple and stubborn. Somewhere inside every stalled opportunity is a question that has not yet been answered cleanly. What exactly makes this choice worth making now?
The pages ahead begin there, where the answer is still forming, and the seller's real work is to help it come into focus. End of introduction. Xerox sales training in the 1960s helped popularize formal sales training as a repeatable craft. But one of the oldest mistakes still presents itself as discipline. A seller enters with a story about the category, the product, and the price, then tries to guide the buyer toward the message already prepared. It feels efficient because the seller controls the sequence. In practice, it often misses the center of the decision. Buyers do not buy products in the abstract.
They buy relief from a problem, progress toward an outcome, and confidence that the choice is sound. That gap matters more in crowded categories than it once did. Comparable features sit close together, and many buyers review specifications and competitors before the first conversation begins. Relevance does more work than feature recital. A polished message still matters. It can clarify, reassure, and build momentum, but its power is limited by the quality of the need it addresses. If the need is vague, trivial, or misread, even a strong presentation lands like theater.
If a strong demo keeps ending with a polite request to send something over, the problem is often not the deck. The conversation never established a reason important enough to decide. Needs-based selling emerged as a corrective to two stubborn habits. One is transaction-first selling, where the goal is to move quickly from contact to offer. The other is feature-first selling, where the seller assumes that enough product detail will somehow create urgency. Both habits are easier to train and easier to inspect in a pipeline review. Neither answers the harder question at the center of any serious purchase.
What problem is important enough, costly enough, or risky enough that action becomes rational now rather than later? At its best, needs-based selling is a sequence of three disciplines. Diagnosis comes first. The seller uncovers the problem, the consequences of leaving it unresolved, the criteria by which options will be judged, and the stakes for the people involved. Alignment comes next. The seller connects only those parts of the offer that bear directly on the diagnosed need. Then comes the ask for the business. Once the fit is clear, the seller asks plainly for the next step or the decision.
That order matters because it makes the close the logical outcome of understanding, not the substitute for it. That modern form of thinking did not appear from nowhere. In the 1960s, large sales organizations helped popularize formal sales training as a repeatable craft rather than just an individual style. That was a major advance. Selling became teachable. Managers could observe, coach, and scale behavior. Yet much of the field still treated the presentation as the center of gravity. Reps were trained to open well, handle objections, and move toward commitment.
The buyer's situation was often treated as context for the pitch, not as the source of the case. Over time, consultative models pushed the discipline in a different direction. The question was no longer only how to present better, it became how to understand better.
By the 1980s, larger purchases involved more risk, more stakeholders, and more internal scrutiny. In 1988, Neil Rackham's spin selling gave that shift a durable structure. Drawing on field research in major sales, Rackham argued that the decisive skill was not a smoother monologue. It was a better sequence of questions.
The situation, problem, implication, and need payoff logic remains foundational because it is simple without being simplistic. Situation questions establish the current facts. Problem questions surface friction, dissatisfaction, or shortfall. Implication questions explore what that problem costs if it persists. Need payoff questions invite the buyer to describe the value of solving it. The sequence shifts the conversation from catalog to consequence. Buyers rarely act because a problem exists alone. They act because the problem becomes consequential.
That also clarifies something that experienced sellers often know instinctively but do not always articulate. Question quality is usually more decisive than pitch quality when the goal is to uncover needs strong enough to justify action. A weak pitch can sometimes be repaired later. A weak diagnosis poisons the entire opportunity. If the first 10 minutes of a meeting are spent defending differentiators, the seller is often arguing before the case has been built. In difficult markets, the most valuable question is not the clever one. It is the one that links present friction to future cost.
Other consultative traditions expanded the same basic turn. Some added decision process thinking, warning that a recognized need is not enough if the route to approval is still opaque. Others organized the sale around diagnosed business problems rather than product description. Still others pushed sellers to understand the buyer's own concept of a solution instead of forcing the seller's version too early. The language differs from model to model, but the family resemblance is strong. Each treats the seller less as a presenter of inventory and more as a guide through a decision. That is why needs-based selling should not be reduced to friendliness. It is not manipulation dressed as curiosity. It is not script reading with a softer voice. It is not rapport that never reaches substance. A seller can ask many questions and still fail at diagnosis. Manipulative questioning tries to herd the buyer toward a predetermined answer. Scripted questioning asks because the playbook says to ask. Rapport without substance produces comfort, but no usable clarity. Diagnosis does something harder.
It tests what is happening, what it costs, who it affects, what a better state looks like, and whether change is important enough to justify action. Here, the distinction between implied and explicit needs becomes especially useful. Many teams call the implied form latent needs. The term matters because these needs are real, but not yet decision ready. A buyer might say that a process is clumsy, a handoff is slow, or a service is unreliable. Those statements signal discomfort. They do not yet establish a business case or a buying case. An explicit need is more developed. It names an outcome or requirement in a form that can support action, such as less downtime, faster onboarding, lower error rates, clearer reporting, more reliable service, or fewer compliance failures. The conversion from latent to explicit is where much of selling actually happens. A slow approval process is irritating until it delays revenue or damages customer retention. An unreliable home internet connection is annoying until it disrupts work calls, school access, streaming, billing confidence, or support expectations. The need deepens when inconvenience turns into loss, exposure, wasted time, reputational harm, or recurring frustration.
Most buying urgency
lives in that movement from inconvenience to a situation that is too expensive, risky, or exhausting to leave alone. This is also where needs-based selling separates itself from pressure. Pressure tries to manufacture urgency from the outside. Diagnosis reveals urgency already present, but not yet fully understood. That is an important ethical and commercial distinction. When the seller exaggerates, the buyer senses it. When the seller helps the buyer understand the implications already built into the situation, resistance often falls because the case no longer depends on salesmanship alone.
The buyer can now explain the need in their own language to colleagues, to the finance team, to family members, or simply to themselves. The challenger sale offers a useful contrast. It argues that strong sellers do not merely respond to needs. They teach, reframe, and challenge assumptions. There is real value in that. Buyers do not always see the full cost of the status quo, and a sharper commercial lens can create genuine insight. But teaching alone is not enough. Detached from diagnosis, teaching becomes another polished presentation.
Reframing works when it lands inside a need the buyer already recognizes, or can quickly recognize, as important. Otherwise, it becomes clever content with no decision underneath it. That balance explains why crowded markets punish feature-first habits so severely. When products are close enough in visible capability, the pitch that wins is rarely the one with the longest list. It is the one that feels most precisely matched to the real decision. In a world of comparison pages, analyst summaries, and instant peer reviews, raw information is abundant. Decision clarity is scarce.
The seller who contributes clarity earns an advantage that feature volume cannot easily match. The same logic appears in business-to-business and business-to-consumer settings, even when the stakes and language differ. Consider an industrial maintenance software purchase. The plant manager is not buying dashboards for their own sake. Operations is buying less unplanned downtime. Finance is buying a return on investment that can be justified. Compliance may be buying a clearer audit trail. Information technology is buying a tool that integrates cleanly and does not create a fresh security burden. In many organizational purchases, buyers weigh several criteria at once. That is why a generic feature parade feels incomplete, even when the product is strong. A household purchase works by the same logic at a different scale. A family choosing home internet is not really buying abstract speed. It is buying stable video calls, fewer service interruptions, predictable billing, responsive support, and confidence that the service will work when it matters. The language is more everyday, and the cycle is usually shorter. The logic remains recognizably the same. What problem does this solve? What goes wrong if it fails?
Is the gain worth the money, the effort, and the switch? Can the seller be trusted after the purchase, not just during it? Across global markets, the hierarchy of needs shifts by category and context. Return on investment sits near the top for some buyers, while others care more about risk reduction. In regulated categories, compliance and service continuity can outrank headline price. In consumer categories, convenience and trust often carry disproportionate weight. A logistics buyer may care first about continuity and exception handling. A hospital may care first about compliance and reliability.
A household may care first about simplicity, support, and the avoidance of future hassle. The seller who assumes one universal hierarchy mistakes category language for decision logic. Seen this way, needs-based selling is not a soft alternative to real selling. It is a more disciplined one. It asks the seller to tolerate ambiguity for longer, to resist the comfort of the early pitch and to accept that diagnosis may narrow the opportunity before it improves it. That last point is easy to overlook. Real diagnosis sometimes reveals that the fit is weak, the timing is poor, or the problem is not important enough.
That can feel like lost momentum in the short term. In practice, it protects time, credibility, and margin. A false opportunity is not a pipeline asset. It is future friction. The common failure pattern, by contrast, is easy to recognize. The seller leads with the category, then the feature set, then price. Only afterward comes the question of what problem is actually being solved. By then, the buyer has learned more about the seller's brochure than about the relevance of the offer. In household markets, that produces comparison shopping with no loyalty.
In business markets, it produces stalled deals, internal hesitation, and requests for one more round of information. When a buying conversation drifts quickly toward features or price, that is often not a sign of clarity. It is a sign that the real issue has not yet been properly named. Needs-based selling offers a better order. Start with diagnosis, move to alignment, then ask clearly for the business. That order sounds obvious when stated plainly, but it is violated every day because pitching feels productive and diagnosis can feel slow. The irony is that good diagnosis usually accelerates the sale that matters.
It sharpens relevance, exposes urgency, reduces avoidable objections, and gives the eventual ask a reason to exist. The seller is no longer trying to make a generic message do the work. The seller is helping the buyer make a specific decision. What matters next is the discipline inside discovery itself, where the right sequence of questions turns a stated interest into a need clear enough to act on. Discovery sounds conversational because it should feel human. Underneath, though, it is structured diagnosis. The seller is not wandering through a pleasant chat and hoping a need will appear.
The seller is moving through current state, friction, consequence, and the value of change. Miss that order, and the conversation usually fails in one of two ways. It stays broad and harmless, or it rushes to solution before the case for change is strong enough to support a decision. That structure matters because serious buying decisions rarely begin with a neat problem statement. Buyers often begin with symptoms, preferences, or requests. A team says it wants better reporting. A household says it wants a lower bill. A department asks for easier integration. Those are useful starting points, but they are not diagnosis.
Good discovery turns surface statements into something more exact. It identifies what is happening now, what is breaking or slowing, what the damage looks like, and what a better outcome must actually deliver. Situation questions do the first part of that work. Their purpose is not to collect trivia. It is to map the buyer's process, operating environment, recent changes, and hard constraints. In a business-to-business setting, that may mean understanding how work moves across teams, which systems are involved, what changed in the last year, and which legal, security, or operational boundaries cannot be ignored.
In a household setting, it may mean understanding who uses the service, what the pattern of frustration has been, and what switching would disrupt. The point is orientation, not volume. The advanced seller is careful here, because situation questions are useful and also easy to abuse. Ask too few, and the diagnosis rests on guesswork. Ask too many, and discovery turns into an intake form. The best questions sound like natural follow-ons to what has just been said. They do not feel bolted on from a script. If a buyer mentions a recent systems change, that earns a question about what the change affected.
If a household buyer mentions repeated service calls, that earns a question about when they occur and what gets interrupted. Each question should remove a real uncertainty, not merely satisfy habit. Good situation questions also respect preparation. Facts that can be learned in advance usually should be. Discovery time is too expensive to spend on what a seller could have known before the meeting. What belongs in the conversation are the specifics that only the buyer can supply. How does the process actually work in practice, not on the diagram? Where are people improvising around policy?
What changed recently that made an old inconvenience newly important? Which deadline, budget limit, or approval rule keeps shaping every choice? Those are living facts, and living facts are where diagnosis begins. Once the current state is clear enough, the conversation needs to tighten. Problem questions move from map to friction. They surface delay, waste, dissatisfaction, missed opportunity, and recurring risk. Where does work stall? What gets redone? Which complaint keeps coming back? What part of the process depends on one overburdened person, one workaround, or one fragile handoff?
In consumer settings, the same logic applies in plainer language. What keeps going wrong? What has become unreliable? What is annoying enough that it is no longer merely annoying? This is also the moment to ask what has already been tried, what failed, and what remains unresolved. Those questions do more than fill in history. They reveal seriousness. A buyer who has attempted 3 partial fixes is telling the seller that the problem is old enough to matter and stubborn enough to resist easy answers. Past attempts also reveal landmines.
If a previous rollout was complex, if a cheaper provider disappointed, or if an internal workaround created new risk, the seller now knows both the scar tissue and the standard of proof the next solution must meet. Problem questions are especially valuable because they separate symptoms from causes. A team may complain about slow onboarding, but the real issue may be manual approvals, incomplete data, poor training, or fear of compliance failure. A household may say price is the problem, when the deeper concern is surprise fees, disputed billing, or the suspicion that support will vanish after the contract is signed.
If the seller stops at the first complaint, the sentence is solved and the decision is missed. The same discipline helps with requested features. Buyers often present features as if they were needs because features are easier to name. Better dashboards, cleaner integration, stronger security, faster setup, 24-hour support, flexible pricing. None of those is meaningless, but none tells the full story by itself. A requested feature often sits on top of a motivation, a fear, or a trade-off. Integration may mean the team cannot tolerate another manual rekeying step.
Security may mean a gatekeeper is worried about exposure and personal accountability. A lower price may reflect a budget limit, or it may signal uncertainty about whether the promised value is real enough to justify commitment. That is why disciplined discovery keeps asking what work the requested feature must do. What does it prevent? What does it speed up? What risk does it reduce? What effort does it save? The seller is not resisting the feature request. The seller is translating it. Until that translation happens, the conversation remains at the level of solution language, not decision language.
Once it happens, the seller can tell whether the feature is central, secondary, or merely habitual. The strongest discovery conversations feel natural because each question is earned by the previous answer. A buyer describes a slow handoff. That earns a question about where the handoff breaks. The answer may reveal missing data or repeated approvals. That, in turn, earns a question about what the delay changes downstream. Does it slow billing, delay revenue recognition, frustrate customers, or create rework for another team? Only after that chain is visible
Does a question about faster implementation or better workflow carry weight?
The conversation narrows because reality narrows it. Implication questions make that narrowing consequential. They connect the problem to cost, exposure, downstream damage, and the price of staying the same. This is often the most uncomfortable part of discovery, which is one reason so many sellers rush past it. It requires patience and accuracy. The seller has to explore what the friction means in practice. If delays continue, what slips? If errors persist, who spends time correcting them? If the system remains unreliable, what happens to customer confidence, audit readiness, or internal trust? Those are not dramatic questions.
They are accounting questions, and they matter precisely because they are concrete. Good implication work never depends on exaggeration. The seller does not invent catastrophe. The seller helps the buyer trace the consequences already present in the situation. A weak handoff is not just a weak handoff if it pushes work into overtime, causes missed commitments, or leaves a manager explaining avoidable mistakes every month. An unreliable service is not merely irritating if it interrupts work, creates household stress, or makes every bill a small act of vigilance. The buyer already lives with the burden.
Discovery simply makes the burden legible. Research summaries tied to the classic implication sequence and later conversation analyses point in the same direction. When sellers stop at surface problems, urgency stays modest. When they explore consequences with discipline, reported urgency rises by about 3 times. The exact figure varies by method, but the pattern is consistent. Problems create interest. Consequences create movement. That is the practical meaning of the number. Buyers act more decisively when the cost of the status quo becomes clear enough to defend action against delay, inertia, and internal scrutiny.
Need payoff questions complete the arc. If implication questions clarify the price of the current state, need payoff questions let the buyer describe the value of resolution in the buyer's own language. That shift matters more than it first appears. A seller can describe benefits well enough, but those benefits remain external until the buyer translates them into local meaning. Faster onboarding may mean quicker revenue recognition for one team, fewer support tickets for another, and less change fatigue for users.
More reliable service may mean fewer interrupted work calls, less family frustration, and more confidence that support will still matter after the sale. This is where discovery becomes especially useful for the buyer's own internal conversations. A person who can clearly describe the value of solving the problem is better equipped to justify budget, defend the choice, and persuade other stakeholders. The seller is no longer carrying the whole argument alone. The buyer can now state why change matters, what it improves, and what trade-off makes sense. That is one reason need payoff questions are so powerful. They do not merely reveal value.
They transfer ownership of the value statement. None of this works reliably unless the seller listens at a higher level than simple turn-taking. The lineage here goes back to Carl Rogers, who helped establish a disciplined approach to listening that treated accurate understanding as the condition for useful progress. Later sales coaching adapted the commercial lesson. Understanding precedes persuasion. A buyer who feels unheard will usually give safer, thinner answers. A buyer who feels accurately understood tends to disclose more of the real decision, including the parts that are awkward, political, or uncertain.
That is not just a humane principle. It is a performance principle. In executive surveys summarized in 2023, 93% identified poor listening as a cause of failure.
In sales performance summaries from the same period, active listening was associated with close rates about 37% higher. Those figures do not prove that listening alone wins the deal. They do show that listening is not soft decoration around the hard work. It is part of the hard work. The seller who does not listen well cannot diagnose well, and the seller who cannot diagnose well usually ends up pitching into fog.
What skilled listening hears is not limited to explicit content. It also hears omissions, repeated phrases, hedges, contradictions, and changes in emotional energy. A buyer may insist that price is the main issue, yet become most animated when implementation risk comes up. Another may keep repeating that the team needs something simple, which may really mean adoption has failed before and patience is low. A third may speak vaguely about timing until security or compliance enters the conversation, then suddenly become exact. Those shifts are diagnostic. They show where the real criteria and fears are concentrated. Omissions matter too.
When a complex rollout depends on user adoption, and no one mentions training, the silence is informative. When a household decision affects multiple people, and only one concern is voiced, the missing concerns often surface later as objections. Contradictions are equally useful. A buyer may say speed matters most, then describe an approval process designed to avoid risk at almost any cost. That does not mean the buyer is dishonest. It means the decision contains competing priorities, and discovery has just exposed them. Several listening disciplines help keep this work practical.
Paraphrase compresses what the buyer has said without distorting it. Summary organizes several points into a clear pattern. Labeling names the likely concern in tentative language so the buyer can confirm or correct it. Deliberate pause gives the answer room to deepen before the next question arrives. Used together, these disciplines prevent discovery from becoming a blur of unprocessed information. They also signal respect because the seller is showing that the answer changed the conversation rather than merely passing through it. A good paraphrase might reduce a long explanation to its essential tension.
A summary might pull together process failure, budget pressure, and timing into one usable frame. A label might identify that the real concern is not just implementation effort, but exposure if the rollout disappoints. Then comes the most neglected discipline of all. Silence is often a better diagnostic tool than rapid interruption. After a buyer admits that the last attempt failed, the tempting move is to hurry into reassurance. The more useful move is often to wait. People frequently continue speaking when the silence is calm, and what they add is often the part that matters most.
That fuller answer is where politics, trade-offs, and emotion tend to appear. Someone explains why the previous vendor lost trust. A manager reveals that senior leadership is watching the category closely. A household buyer admits that support quality matters more than the lowest monthly price. None of those details is guaranteed to surface if the seller treats every answer as a cue for the next prepared question. Silence, used well, does not slow discovery. It improves the quality of what discovery captures. At a certain point, listening has to produce confirmation.
The seller can play back the diagnosed problem, the consequence, and the desired outcome in the buyer's own language, then leave room for correction. That confirmation does two things at once. It checks accuracy, and it demonstrates comprehension. A seller might reflect that the current process creates repeated delay. The delay damages service or revenue or internal confidence.
and any solution has to improve speed without creating new security or adoption problems. Then the seller stops. If the buyer refines that picture, the diagnosis improves. If the buyer agrees, the case becomes sturdier.
Discovery also has to surface decision criteria early enough to matter. A clear need is necessary, but it is not sufficient. The seller still has to know how the options will be judged. Across buying studies, decision teams often work with 5 to 7 criteria. A common weighting puts roughly 40% on technical factors, 35% on business factors, and 25% on financial factors. The mix shifts by category and region, but the pattern is revealing. Capability alone rarely decides the outcome. The offer must work, must make practical business sense, and must survive financial scrutiny.
Technical criteria usually answer whether the solution functions, integrates, protects data, and performs reliably in the buyer's environment. Business criteria answer whether the change can be adopted, whether it improves operations, whether it supports compliance or continuity, and whether the organization can absorb it without disruption. Financial criteria answer the total cost, the speed of value, and whether the return on investment is believable enough for approval. That is where Miller-Hyman blue sheet thinking remains useful.
It treats the opportunity not as a conversation with one contact, but as a decision system with influence, process, and criteria. That distinction matters. Knowing who likes the idea is not the same as knowing who can delay it, who funds it, who must sign off, and what sequence leads from interest to approval. In business-to-business committees especially, the visible contact may be only one part of the map. A hidden influencer may shape requirements from the background. A budget holder may care less about features than about payback and contract structure. A final approver may focus on downside protection above all else.
The practical question is always the same. Who is optimizing for what? One person wants speed because the backlog is painful. Another wants adoption because unused tools are political failures. Another wants compliance because a bad audit is career-threatening. Another wants lower total cost because budgets are under pressure. Another wants risk reduction because recent mistakes have raised the cost of being wrong. Discovery becomes far sharper once those motives are visible. The seller can then tell whether a stated need is broadly shared or merely local, and whether the proposed value speaks to the people who actually determine the outcome.
Across regions, those emphases do vary. Some cross-market surveys find stronger emphasis on return on investment in Asian markets, with about 65% of respondents placing it near the top of the decision. Other surveys find greater risk aversion in parts of Europe, around 55%. Those are tendencies, not rules, and they should never become stereotypes. Their value is simpler. They remind the seller to test local decision logic instead of assuming that every market ranks speed, price, innovation, and risk the same way. A software purchase makes the interaction of criteria especially clear.
Integration may matter because disconnected systems create delay and manual work. Security may matter because the organization cannot add exposure or trigger a long review. Onboarding may matter because no one wants a tool that technically works but never reaches user adoption. Time to value may matter because an executive sponsor needs visible improvement within the budgeting cycle. In one deal, integration leads. In another, security leads. In a third, the deciding issue is not either one. It is whether users can adopt the system fast enough to make the promised return credible. The surface language can be misleading here.
Integration can be code for implementation speed. Security can be code for personal and organizational risk. Fast onboarding can be code for confidence in adoption. Time to value can be code for budget defensibility. That is why the disciplined seller does not merely collect criteria. The seller interprets them in context and tests which ones are truly decisive. A household purchase follows the same pattern at a smaller scale. Convenience matters because no one wants a service that creates recurring hassle. Trust matters because billing promises and support quality are difficult to verify before purchase.
Price matters, but often alongside a quieter concern about hidden fees, poor responsiveness, or the exhaustion of switching again in 6 months. After-sales support matters because the real judgment of the seller begins when something goes wrong. Even in consumer decisions, there is often more than one stakeholder: the person paying, the person arranging installation, and the people living with the service may not rank the trade-offs in exactly the same way. All of this can go wrong if discovery turns into interrogation. A rigid checklist makes the seller feel prepared and makes the buyer feel processed.
The questions may all be reasonable, yet the conversation still dies because nothing seems responsive to what was just said. Another failure is subtler. Discovery becomes a disguised prelude to the pitch. Every question is asked only so the seller can steer back to the prepared message. Buyers recognize that move quickly. When no answer can change the seller's direction, the questions stop feeling like diagnosis and start feeling like theater.
From many frustrations, isolate the ones that create real cost, exposure, or fatigue. From many possible criteria, find the handful that will actually decide the outcome. From all the people around the decision, locate the few whose approval, hesitation, or resistance changes what happens next. Good discovery does not end with more material than it began with. It ends with fewer uncertainties and a sharper case. That is the turning point, where diagnosis gives way to alignment. Because once the decisive need, criteria, and stakeholders are clear, the real task is to show how a specific offer fits them without pretending to solve what discovery has ruled out. Once the need is confirmed, the conversation changes shape. The seller restates three things: the problem worth solving, the cost of leaving it alone, and the outcome the buyer wants badly enough to spend time, money, and internal approval on. Leave out any one of those, and alignment becomes guesswork.
State them clearly, and the close feels less like pressure because the reason to decide is already in view. That restatement has to use the buyer's language, not the seller's product vocabulary. A slow approval chain is not just a workflow issue. For the buyer, it may mean faster revenue without losing control. Repeated service outages are not just a reliability issue. They can mean fewer support calls, more stable access, and fewer weekends lost to repair work. A request for easier reporting may really mean fewer manual reconciliations, cleaner executive visibility, and less month-end strain.
The job is to translate each confirmed need into an outcome the buyer already recognizes as worth pursuing. That translation is where many capable sellers slide back into catalog mode. They hear a need and answer with features. The better move is narrower. A serious proposal should sound like the decision the buyer is trying to make, not like the seller's internal naming system. When the buyer says the real problem is delay, risk, rework, surprise billing, or failed adoption, the response stays anchored there. Features matter, but only as the means to an outcome the buyer already cares about. Define the terms as the conversation tightens.
A feature is what the offer has.
An advantage is where it performs better, faster, or with less effort than another option. A benefit is the changed condition for the buyer. In most decisions, buyers do not stop at the feature. They decide at the level of the benefit. And in larger purchases, they often decide at the level of the business outcome behind it. If a platform enables cleaner integration, the feature is the technical capability, and the buyer-recognized outcome is less rekeying, fewer delays, and a lower chance that adoption collapses under manual work.
If a service uses flat billing, the feature is the billing design, and the buyer-recognized outcome is predictability and fewer unpleasant surprises. Alignment, then, has to cover more than product to problem. In serious purchases, the offer fits technical, business, and financial logic at the same time. Many decision teams work with 5 to 7 criteria. A common weighting gives about 40% to technical issues, 35% to business issues, and 25% to financial ones. The exact mix changes by category and market, but the point holds.
A proposal that answers only capability is incomplete, even when capability is strong. Technical fit covers function, reliability, integration, security, and performance in the buyer's environment. Business fit covers adoption, implementation burden, compliance, continuity, and stakeholder alignment. Financial fit covers total cost of ownership, payback period, and return on investment. These categories matter because buying logic is rarely singular. A seller can win technical approval and still lose on adoption. A seller can prove business value and still stall if the financial case stays vague.
The offer has to survive the full decision, not just the most visible part. Because fit matters so much, proof has to be organized around the buyer's criteria, not the seller's favorite talking points. The best proof point is not broad enthusiasm. It is time saved, risk reduced, revenue protected, or friction removed. If the buyer cares about integration, the proof shows implementation speed, fewer manual steps, or lower error exposure. If the buyer cares about compliance, the proof shows traceability, control, and a cleaner audit path.
If the buyer cares about price, the proof shows the real cost of living with the choice over time, not just the opening invoice. Good proof does not decorate the sale. It answers the question that could still stop it. In business-to-business selling, 4 themes recur with unusual regularity: integration, adoption, compliance, and stakeholder alignment. Integration asks whether the new choice works with the systems and processes already in place. Adoption asks whether people will use it after launch. Compliance asks whether the organization can live with the legal, security, and record-keeping burden.
Stakeholder alignment asks whether operations, finance, information technology, security, procurement, and any executive sponsor can each defend the choice for their own reasons. A solution that satisfies only one group often reaches late-stage review and then slows. Business-to-consumer alignment sounds plainer, but the structure is similar. Convenience means the purchase removes hassle rather than moving it somewhere else. Trust means the promise is believable before the sale and remains believable after it. Price clarity means the buyer understands the real cost well enough not to fear hidden fees or shifting terms.
After-sales support means the relationship still functions when something breaks, which is when many consumer judgments are actually made. A household may not describe the decision in procurement language, but it is still weighing fit across several dimensions at once. This is why price has to be handled through value framing rather than discount reflex. The harder and more useful question is, expensive compared with what? Cost,
over what period, and with what consequence. In business markets, that means total cost of ownership, implementation effort, training time, operating savings, payback, and return on investment.
A cheaper tool that takes longer to adopt, requires more workarounds, or creates more risk may have the higher real cost. In consumer markets, the same logic appears as billing clarity, contract burden, support quality, replacement frequency, and the time cost of fixing failures. Price looks isolated only when the rest of the value has not yet been made legible. When a buyer says the offer is too expensive, the disciplined response is not an immediate concession. It is diagnosis.
Expensive? Relative to a competitor's sticker price? Relative to a fixed budget line? Relative to the cost of staying the same? Or relative to uncertainty about whether the promised outcome will actually arrive? The objection sounds financial, but it is often evidentiary. The buyer is not yet sure the outcome is real enough to justify commitment. A close becomes appropriate when the seller can name the buyer's priority, the consequence of inaction, the main risks, the decision authority, the timing window, and the budget path without guessing. The conversation has crossed from exploration into decision readiness.
The buyer may still need a final review, but the reasons for action and the terms of evaluation are clear enough to state. That clarity is what makes a direct ask feel professional instead of premature. Trial closes help test readiness without forcing it. They check whether the diagnosed fit is complete, whether an approval step is still missing, or whether one criterion remains unproven. A good trial close asks, in effect, whether the proposed approach covers the priorities already named and what, if anything, still has to be established before a decision or a firm next step.
In larger deals, that next step can be a security review, a pilot design, commercial terms, or access to a final approver. In consumer selling, it may be confirmation that the offer meets the household's requirements and that installation or delivery can proceed cleanly. Seen from this angle, objections look different. Most are not barricades to be defeated. They are signs of unresolved uncertainty, a missing stakeholder, or an unconfirmed criterion. Timing objections often mean the consequence of delay has not been fully accepted, or the organization has not arranged the bandwidth to act.
Authority objections often mean the real decision map is still incomplete. Budget objections may reflect genuine constraints, but they also frequently signal that payback, total cost, or proof remains unclear. Trust objections usually mean the buyer is still unsure whether the seller will be dependable once the contract is signed. The practical rule is to work every objection back to the need and the consequence. If the buyer says timing is not right, the seller asks what becomes more difficult, costly, or risky if the decision slips.
If the buyer says someone else must approve, the seller establishes which criterion that person will judge and what proof they will require. If the buyer says budget is tight, the seller determines whether the issue is cash, prioritization, payback period, or uncertainty. If the buyer says more time is needed to think, the useful follow-up is clarification about what exactly remains unconfirmed. A simple objection map keeps the work honest. Sort hesitation into uncertainty, timing, authority, budget, or trust. Then name what sits underneath it. The missing criterion, the missing stakeholder, or the missing proof point.
Before deciding on the next move, a disciplined seller makes three questions explicit. What is still unproven? Who still matters? What evidence would make the answer usable? Without that review, follow-up becomes motion without progress. Only after that groundwork does closing technique deserve serious attention. The summary close often fits complex decisions best because it restates the confirmed need, the consequence of inaction, the criteria that matter, and how the proposed solution fits them.
A choice-based close can help when the buyer has already accepted the fit, and the live question is which version, timing, or term structure makes the most sense. The assumptive close has a place too, but it belongs late, after the buyer is already behaving like a chooser rather than an evaluator. A weak close usually reflects a weak diagnosis, not a missing trick at the end. In the same way that stalled discovery signals unresolved uncertainty, stalled alignment signals something still not proven. Criteria mismatches that remain unresolved cause deals to slow or stop. The stall rarely begins in the last minute.
It begins earlier, when one decision rule stays vague, one stakeholder stays outside the process, or one proof point never becomes credible enough. That is why the closing checklist stays plain. Recap the need, the consequence of inaction, and the desired outcome. Confirm fit against the technical, business, and financial criteria that govern the choice. Ask directly for the decision or the next committed step. Then secure agreement on what happens next, who owns it, and when it occurs. If any part of that sequence feels unstable, the answer is not a more theatrical close. The answer is a return to diagnosis, proof, or stakeholder alignment.
Written proposals should follow the same order. Open with the buyer's situation, not the seller's biography. Translate recommended capability into the outcome it serves. Attach proof where the buyer's scrutiny will fall hardest. Make the commercial case legible. Then show the path from acceptance to implementation, support, or renewal. A proposal built this way travels better inside a committee because it already answers the committee's actual questions. It does not ask the buyer to translate the seller's language into decision language after the meeting. One final discipline matters: installed opportunities.
Before chasing the deal forward, run a decision review. Name the exact criterion still missing, the stakeholder who has not yet weighed in, or the proof point that remains too weak. If none of those can be named clearly, the opportunity is not ready for closing pressure. It is ready for better understanding. That small pause saves time by preventing activity from being mistaken for progress. Taken together, the method stays more demanding than pitch-first selling because it forces the seller to earn the close.
It requires preparation before the meeting, disciplined listening during discovery, restraint during alignment, and clarity at decision time. It also makes better use of the buyer's intelligence. Instead of trying to overcome hesitation through force of presentation, the seller helps the buyer reach decision readiness. That is why needs-based selling travels well across markets and categories. Whether the sale is a complex enterprise system or a household service, the core task stays the same.
Diagnose the problem accurately. Match the solution honestly. Prove the value in the buyer's terms. And ask for action when the conditions for a sound decision are actually present. What remains important is keeping track of what has been proven, what is still uncertain, and how each closing conversation lines up with the buyer's criteria. That discipline keeps the seller honest about the decision that is actually in front of the buyer. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.